Hello and welcome to episode number 347 of the Super Horror Bros podcast. I'm your host Matt, and joining me as always is my brother Mike.
Hello.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
Good. We are back again, back on the old digital services, as we have been for a little while now. But yeah, this is one that we wanted to see at the cinema. We just couldn't because we were both dead that week.
Big story.
Yeah, but luckily enough, you don't have to wait any very long these days. Like, it's so crazy how quick that turnaround is now.
It's mad, isn't it? Yeah, I'm not used to it still. Like, when this became available, it was like, really?
So mad. Like, I feel, because, like, today, Evil Dead Rise is out digital, and it's like, I feel like we watched that so recently, you know. I mean, it was, like, 2 weeks ago, and it's all, and it obviously it done really well as well. It's just that window now for films to make money is basically 3 weeks at the cinema, and anything past, they're like, yeah, we'll just release it on digital.
I know what you mean, though, but, like, I like that. Like, I remember, like, when we first started doing this podcast, we were moaning about, like, how are we this far when we have to wait, like, 9 months, you know? We see, like Quiet Place or something, like one of those kind of earlier ones that where we're like, fuck, we really want to watch this before year. I remember It, like, we saw that in, like, September, and we're like, well, we're not going to get to see that again before year end.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's crazy to think of now. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was calling it out at the time and being like, it shouldn't matter. Like, the people don't go to cinema to see movies early. People go to cinema because they want to see movies on the big screen, or they're out, or, you know, there are various different reasons. But I think having that 6 month wait isn't a reason. No. You know, if you wanted to see Renfield at the cinema, you chose to do that. And, you know, if you knew it was going to be on demand in a couple of weeks, they get the money that way.
Yeah, I think it's perfect now. Like you say, that before it was just too crazy, because like a 4 month wait plus, like basically 4 to 6 months was probably the average, and that was way too extreme. Whereas obviously during COVID, a lot of the experimental stuff, I think they found that releasing stuff day and date digital was a problem, and I think it would have been the death of cinema long term, because like it just undercut so many films' box office budget or revenue rather. Whereas I think, yeah, now is the time that, like, say, if you want to see Renfield, it's or any film, like, it's you might wait 1 or 2 weeks, but like anything past that, I think is kind of nuts. Where, like, if you're the person that's like, oh, I really, especially horror films, where you're like, oh yeah, I really wanted to see Evil Dead Rise, but I was going to wait 4 weeks to go watch it. It's like, well, you didn't really want to go see it. You'll maybe go see it on a whim. If you were actually really excited for it, you would have seen it within that first 3 or 4 weeks, I think. So yeah, I think that's the way to do it. Release it cinema, but then everyone kind of knows, like, oh, I couldn't make it. Or like for us, we had, like, you know, real world reasons why we couldn't go see this film at the cinema. Yeah. We knew it was coming really, really quickly. Which, yeah, I think it's awesome for sure. And yeah, I hope it continues. Like you say, if any of these films, like, upcoming, you know, if we start to see that trend the other way again. And like, it's cool because even big movies, like, I feel like Avatar, which was obviously like the biggest film of the last year, that didn't even have like an insane run. And it's like, you know, it wasn't 3 weeks, of course not. Like, they had a more protected cinema run. But even that wasn't as crazy as it was.
That's the most theatrical movie that's come out since Avatar. And, yeah. You know, will be the most theatrical until Avatar 3, you know. There are people that will just watch the Marvel movies, you know, at home or whatever. But I think with Avatar, you know, that's such a cinema experience as proven by the box office, you know. So, yeah, like you say, watching these movies, you know, watching Renfield really at the cinema or at home, you know, we'll get into it. But, like, I don't see that, you know, it didn't feel like a cinema movie. It felt like one that... It was fine watching it at home. I don't feel like I got a lesser experience.
I also like that as well. Like, this is still at the cinema. So, because I just searched for it to kind of pull up the Wikipedia, and it
obviously... Well, we nearly went.
Like, yeah.
For last week's show.
Yeah, but like on Google, it obviously shows you like, oh, here's local, you know, listings in your area, and it's still showing like a couple of times a day, like locally. So I'm like, oh, that's cool. Again, and I feel like a lot of these, you know, Evil Dead clearly still will, even though you can watch it on digital. Like a lot of the stuff that we've recently covered is does sort of still hang around in the cinema for a little while. So yeah, it's really, really good. I feel like it took them a while. Like we said that at the time, in the midst of the craziness of 2020, that like it's gonna take people time to figure this stuff out. There were certain production companies that kind of got off to a flyer and knew exactly what they were doing. There was like Warner, who kind of did the whole HBO deal in the long term, or in the short term rather, which I feel like was always just a case of like, we've got all this stuff out that we don't want to delay for years. And it was cool that we didn't have to just delay all of their films for years, but it was also like, come on, you can't, like, if they couldn't have released The Matrix and The Batman and all these huge films on demand, it just would have been insane. And obviously, yeah, getting to like John Wick and stuff, like, yeah, we need to have these big sort of tempo releases. But yeah, anyway, to get to the news this week, there's only a couple of items, but this first one is awesome. It's about as awesome as the news gets, really, because I love that when we kind of mention a film for the first time, this will be the first time this has ever been mentioned, and it will immediately become one of our most anticipated horror films. And yeah, this is not over-exaggerating.
We've definitely spoken about Meg 2 before.
We have talked about that film, but there's a new sort of announcement, I guess, of an upcoming project by someone that we might have covered once or twice on this podcast, in the film and television realm, which is the busiest man in horror, Mr. Mike Flanagan. Who, of course, has kind of jumped ship from Netflix to Amazon on the TV sphere, even though he still has a Netflix show coming out later this year, which I think is I think it's The Fall of House of Usher. I think that's the one that's still to come. Yeah. There was already
his violent one.
Yeah, that was it. And I feel like we've already spoke about the first show on Amazon, which I just can't remember off the top of my head. I'm sure it's some sort of weird novel that he loves that he's adapting. But yeah, we got news here, and I think by far this makes it the most exciting, because this is what I've wanted and have been preaching about for years on this podcast, that he's making a bloody film again. Which I'm so excited for. Like, of course, his TV is excellent, exquisite, some of the best TV ever. Of course, Midnight Mass and Haunted of Hill House being the two standouts for sure. But obviously, we've discussed him doing Gerald's Game, Doctor Sleep. What was the other one? That Hush as well. Yeah. Like, he's had multiple top 10 films for us that have trended more towards top 5 as well. And it's been a long time. I mean, Doctor Sleep was 2019 that we last had a film from Mike Flanagan. And obviously, we're talking about this now, like, this is probably next year. So it's going to be 5 years, which, like we say, for someone who is so busy like he's been, like, he's put out a TV show pretty much every year since then. But I'm so thankful that he's returning to the world of film. And we know what the project is, and unsurprisingly, off the back of Gerald's Game and Doctor Sleep, he's going back into the world of Stephen King, of course. I also love that there's already a trend here where it's like, if he can get the rights to other books, he's like, yeah, this is a TV thing. But if he gets Stephen King, it's like, okay, this is going to be a film, which I think makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, he's like, I can't, like, put that on.
Yeah, plus also I think it speaks volumes of how much it costs to acquire a Stephen King adaptation versus these other books.
What are you talking about? Like, I can't see any reason why they'd be expensive.
No. So yeah, this is the title of this is The Life of Chuck. This all comes courtesy of Deadline as of today. And it's, yeah, so it's a short story, this one, which obviously leaves massive room for sort of interpretation, which I find very exciting. And it's from King's 2020 anthology, If It Bleeds. So obviously a collection of short stories, very recent, in fact. And yeah, The Life of Chuck is apparently three separate stories linked to tell the biography of Charles Krantz in reverse, beginning with his death from a brain tumor at 39 and ending with his childhood in a supposedly haunted house, which sounds very Mike Flanagan indeed. We also have casting at this point already. We know who's going to play the lead as well as another character. So the lead will be played by Tom Hiddleston, who will play the titular character, Chuck. I'm curious, though, because obviously this is going to be in multiple timelines, so not sure when. Two of the three would be my guess.
Yeah, definitely. And, like, that would be pretty exciting as cast announcement, like, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's pretty sweet. Like, Loki, cool.
Yeah, it's cool. And like I say, I'm sure there's going to be plenty more at a later date, and I'm sure there's going to be some returning names. But, yeah, these are both kind of new to the family. Well, I guess, so this next one, very exciting indeed, is Mark Hamill, who will apparently be playing the role of Albie. But I think Mark Hamill is in the Netflix show this year. So I think this is a returning one.
I was going to say, I swear we have spoken about... Mark Hamill and Flanagan before, like,
yeah,
like deja vu. So I'm almost certain he is in House of Usher.
I think he is as well. So yeah, he's obviously in this as well. And yeah, this is very exciting. Obviously, this is like, and this is Flanagan directing. He will also write the script and produce through his Intrepid Pictures company. It also adds here, just rather interestingly, that Netflix adapted Mr. Harrigan's Phone, which was another King story, short story, also pulled from this same anthology last year, the same anthology, which we didn't get to see that, but I was interested in that one on Netflix. And then just a final note before we kind of, I want to get your thoughts on this. But yeah, that kind of deadline, in the Deadline article, it said about how this will be a hot package at the upcoming Cannes market. Now, initially, I read this, so I did just Google it, and Cannes Film Festival is next week, which makes sense why they're obviously announcing this now. When I first read that, I was like, oh, okay, so, like, is this film done? And, like, it's going to get screened, and then, obviously, they kind of do the whole distributors bidding war, as it were. But what I imagine this is that this is a case of Flanagan will be there, he will present it to people. Yeah. He's obviously got two massive actors already signed on, he's got the IP, he's got everything to go, and then I imagine it will then be a case of... And especially with someone like Flanagan, like, they already know what he brings to the table, so then it'll be a case of probably getting who will be, like, the main distributors and potentially the funding as well.
I think it's he had a big old pot of money and acquired some Stephen King IP, and now he has a smaller pot of money, and so you know, but he's like, yeah, he should have enough goodwill. You know, Flanagan, Stephen King, two really good actors. That's not a hard sell. Like, that's really not a hard sell at all.
No, exactly. But I mean, overall, how excited are you? Obviously, we knew we were getting more Flanagan at different times, and obviously still continuing on Netflix, going into Amazon and all that stuff. And it's been amazing. Of course it has. And I think when the next proper, not to kind of disregard these other Flanagan shows, but we know that there's a difference between him overseeing and directing every episode, like he did Midnight Mass, which was the last one, to what was the one last year that you watched on Netflix?
Oh, Christ.
Midnight Club, wasn't it?
Yeah, Midnight Club.
Yeah, so, like, there's a massive difference between those, and we know that. But, yeah, he's doing a film, and I think that's exceptionally exciting. And I think, yeah, it already... I'm, like, struggling to think... Obviously, Jordan Peele has got a new movie as well, and hopefully that's a horror film. But, like, this is so exciting, isn't it? That finally, after all these years, Flanagan's returning to the big screen.
I think so, definitely. And I think as well, like, you know, with it being a Stephen King IP, I'm glad it's, like, a short story that I'm not too familiar with. Like, I can't say that, like, the plot is something where I'm like, oh, hell yeah. But I'm not really fussed about that. I'm more... happy that he's got something that he can flesh out a bit more, and you know, that worked well with kind of, you know, some of the other stuff he's done. And I think kind of instead of him tackling like a giant novel like Dr. Sleep, because he isn't just recreating the source material. And I think if you're, you know, if you've got The Shining in front of you, you probably not a great example seeing as what Kubrick did, but you know, any of these big novels, though, you know, you kind of want to stick with the source material. And if you don't, you are going to have people like with what Kubrick did. Kubrick turned, like, made his own spin on it, but people are going to always hate it. Whereas with this, it's like, cool, it's this lesser known IP, it's a short story, you can have creative freedom on it, and you still get that King cachet, and you still get that King, like, backbone, but you get to have some Flanaganisms in there as well. And so I think it can be the best of both worlds.
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad it's a short story as well. And I do want to look this up after the podcast and kind of see how short we're talking. Mm. Not only for context, but like if this is really short, I probably will read it before seeing it. Because in that case, I'd be like, okay, if this is turning into a feature, I would like to know like the similar to what we got with The Black Phone, where it was such a short story that like we knew that they were going to have to fill in so many gaps to make it into a feature film.
Whereas if it's conversation fun at that point, because, yeah, it is going to be so different.
Exactly. Whereas if it is like, this is maybe this If It Bleeds anthology, because I remember the Joe Hill anthology that I read that was like a collection of short stories. And a couple of those were basically like stories. They were almost novels. And then there was a couple of really short ones. So it's very hard to tell with these people that like, is it under 50 pages or is it like 120 pages? Like there's a big difference there.
That's the thing. Like some of those Joe Hill ones were, half the length of a and some people's novels wouldn't even be that big. It's just the fact that when King pens something, he's like, penning 300 pages, and he's like, I've only done 85 this time. I'll come with some short stories. And he's like, fuck me. Most people just would release that.
I've got a suspicion it's that, because the fact that it says that this it's three different timelines. I'm like, this is it, basically. I'm curious to look up more of this, but I'm so excited either way. And then the next news story, there's another new sort of film announcement that happened today, actually. This one from Netflix. This is like really interesting, I think. So do you remember Bird Box? Of 2018 film. That happened, it feels like a lifetime ago now. And it's weird to think that was like the same. Wasn't that like a couple of months after A Quiet Place?
It was very soon.
Which I feel like was why it wasn't, at least for us, as well received. Because when I look back on it now, I'm like, oh yeah, it was a cool film. Like, I enjoyed it. But I think we were probably more harsh on it because of how close it was to it. Like, if that came out last year.
Absolutely the problem.
Yeah. And they talked, it was a massive hit for Netflix at the time. And it was kind of weird that they didn't immediately greenlight a sequel. I know they were talking about Bird Box 2 forever. But they kind of announced today with like an announcement, a trailer and a release date for a new film called Bird Box Barcelona. And rather interestingly, this is a spin-off movie set within the world, but it is a Spanish language film. So obviously a completely different cast of characters, but it's a kind of international take on the movie in that world. And so it's out July 14th, so just a couple of months away. I haven't bothered watching the trailer because I'm trying to avoid trailers as much as possible because I feel like I've just been so negative on trailers in general lately. But I like this idea a lot, especially... especially films about apocalypses, I was thinking about with A Quiet Place, and like The Last of Us is one that people have talked about for years, where with a lot of these things that do such a good job creating worlds specifically, they are 9 times out of 10 centered around the United States, which obviously makes a lot of sense. But I always think like, what is going on in the world of The Last of Us in Japan? Like how did the cordyceps get there and stuff like that? So to see like, just as a concept, I love this. And so the fact that they're doing it, where they're like, it's Bird Box. We know the kind of general setup to what makes Bird Box Bird Box, which I can remember. You know, it has like a strong visual style of the kind of the blindfolds and stuff. Like, it's a very cool thing. But to put that in a completely different setting and different language as well, I think is awesome. I have no idea if this looks good because I've not seen the trailer, but I'm really excited to check this one out. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I am too. I think it's one where if it was just like Bird Box 2, and it's like, further into the apocalypse, or whatever, and trying to rekindle with characters that I don't really remember from the first one, et cetera, I'd be like, I don't know. But I think, as you said, it's a great idea. I remember massively with 28 Weeks Later, where I was like, it ends and they're in front of the Eiffel Tower. And I was like, fuck, I want that sequel. Like, I want to see that in Paris. And I want the events of 28 weeks to be the reason for, the catalyst for the infection in, however long it is, in Paris. And just be like, seeing Day One again, but from a different country and a different perspective. Yeah, I think would be really cool, and I think that's something that yeah, it's kind of wild that it's not been touched upon, really. You know, and I think it just would be great, you know, when we've got these IP like Cloverfield and that sort of thing that have taken risks and jumps with the IP, you know, the fact that they've never done anything like that, you know, because I think thinking back to 28 weeks, you know, the whole world was aware of what happened and had kind of quarantined the UK off, and then slowly were letting people back in and slowly trying to recreate. And it would have been great if it was like, well, we fucked that up, guys. Like, why did we ever go into the UK? We should have just, we got it written off and we should have just left it that way. And you know, now we've not done that. France is fucked. And now that's going to bleed into Europe. Like, great. You know, and it would be great, and then like to see that slowly like spread around the world. I'm well up for that, and also up for Bird Box.
No, definitely. Like I'm completely with you that like I'm excited for this, but my mind just goes to all these other places, and obviously things that we do like more. You know, like A Quiet Place. Like thinking about how there is a spin-off movie upcoming, and it probably will play it safe. Like hopefully the movie will be awesome. But I go back to The Last of Us, which at least in the TV show, you know, we did see a different country for the first time, which we never got in either of the games. Oh god, it annoys me now that I can't remember specifically where it was. Like I want to say Indonesia, but it sounds wrong.
I literally was going to say that too and thought it sounded wrong. So
yeah, because obviously they
wrong to make
it
right.
Yeah, because obviously it comes in the flour that the company's producing, and that's kind of where like the cordyceps stemmed from, and that's how it happened in America. Like it's so awesome. And yeah, like even something like that, where if you have a country that is, you know, going to be locked off by the world via water, similar to the UK, like you said, with 28 weeks. Like, I love that concept of world, of being like, right, you're going to shut off this entire country from the world. And how do other countries respond to that? And letting in, you know, people and refugees that are trying to flee that country into their country. Like, there's so much room there for great storytelling. And again, I have no idea whether this is going to be that. Like, maybe it's just exactly the same movie, but oh, it's now in Spain.
I almost feel like we've done a classic art.
Oh no, this is what it's all about. You know, if we can just spitball for 5 minutes and come up with better shit, then that is a problem for them. But I'm excited for this. And it's another, you know, like Netflix has been quiet. Like I feel like we've only really covered TV on Netflix for a while. Like I want to see more films on Netflix, because you know we had like the Great Fear Street movies and stuff like that. Like I want to see them do more shit. So I'm definitely down for this for sure.
There's a few that they've snuck out as well in the last kind of six to nine months, but just none that have been like super interesting.
Yeah, that's the thing. Because even like, what was that? The foreign language, the platform, that foreign language film that we saw on Netflix. Yeah, that was like super cool. So yeah, I'd love to see more stuff like that just kind of break out. I'll have to maybe do some digging and see if anything's came on the platform this year, because we've still got a pretty quiet schedule ahead of us.
I remember like Aftermath was one that came out, I think like last year maybe.
Right.
And that was one on Netflix where it was like, it looked kind of ghosty and haunty and like, I was like, no thanks, but it kind of, you know, it was one where it was like, yeah, this felt like, you know, it was a new horror that was landing on Netflix, but it just didn't speak to me. So they kind of have a couple, but yeah, just nothing crazy.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, that's it for the news this week. Shall we talk about this week's film?
Let's do it.
Let's talk about Renfield. So yeah, I feel like this one doesn't really need a massive introduction, because we've probably talked about this one quite a bit in the recent weeks.
Well, I think we previewed before at the end of an episode 2 or 3 weeks ago, because we didn't think we were going to die, so we planned to watch it.
Exactly, yeah, we thought we were going to see this and then we didn't. We've discussed like seeing the trailer in the news when this initially was first announced, and it was like, oh, Nick Cage playing Dracula, and then obviously seeing Nicholas Holt earlier this year being fantastic in The Menu. So there's plenty of us talking up Renfield in this year for sure. So I feel like, yeah, just dive into it really. really. Like, what is Renfield actually about, and who is Renfield?
Yeah, well, Renfield is played by Nicholas Hoult, and yeah, Renfield is basically Dracula's henchman, butler, kind of, you know, his guy in the chair, metaphorically speaking.
It's his familiar.
Yeah, sure. And Dracula is played by the one and only Nick Cage. And yeah, basically we join Renfield kind of, well, I was going to say decades, but probably centuries into serving Dracula. And Dracula is hit on hard times. He got a little bit fried by some priests and is in a state of recovery. And he needs Renfield to bring him some nice people to eat. And Renfield kind of gets to a bit of a crisis in life when he doesn't really want to do that anymore. And he doesn't he doesn't get the pleasure from it and doesn't want to keep taking nice people. So he's kind of started to take, like, shitty people to Dracula, but isn't enjoying that either, and kind of basically has an epiphany where he wants to step away and joins a self-help group, and through this self-help group kind of finds his own inner self and decides to branch away from Dracula. But Nick Cage, i.e. Dracula, will not go down without a fight, and decides to wreak havoc on Renfield and his new associates. I guess one of the things is with Renfield, because I'm sure, like in Dracula lore or whatever, if you're familiar, then you may be familiar with Renfield, etc. But, like, I didn't know the rules, really, of what Renfield would be. Like, is he mortal? Is he just immortal but with no powers? Or, you know, how does he work? Can he go out at night? Or is he affected by daylight, like Dracula clearly is? You know, all of these things. But basically, like, Renfield is a completely normal dude. He can go out in daylight, etc. But is immortal. And basically, if he eats anything living, he gets a taste of Dracula's powers. So he almost gets like this drug-induced, like, you know, fury of Dracula power. And he usually gets his fix by carrying a little matchbox full of insects, and you can just pop a spider or pop a cockroach and get that, you know, just that little taste of life, and does it that way, as opposed to kind of, you know, drinking someone's blood, which, you know, is a little bit more socially frowned upon. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, if I saw someone munching cockroaches in the corner of the room, I probably wouldn't like invite him over for a drink, but I'd at least be way more suspicious of the dude, like, drinking someone's blood. Do you know what I mean? Like, there are layers to it and levels to it. And he's certainly a stage down with what he's chosen to do in life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you go. Talk to me.
Yeah, I mean, so to start with, just to, what you're saying about Renfield and kind of like how familiar, pun intended, we were with the character. Like, I'm with you that I didn't really know too much about him. And obviously it was only when this movie first got announced, called Renfield starring, you know, Nick Cage's Dracula, where I'm like, okay, what's going on here? And it was only like last year or so that I was like, oh, okay, that's the name of his sort of servant. And obviously that's why it's called that and stuff. But yeah, I wasn't familiar with him, so I didn't have a clue that he like had these powers. He could like eat these creatures or you know, these critters and become powerful. I am very much aware of what a familiar is, purely because of the TV show What We Do in the Shadows,
right?
Which is all about familiars. So like, as soon as he said like I'm Dracula's familiar, I was like, oh, that makes perfect sense to me. But it was definitely a few things that are unclear. Like, did they ever say how or why Renfield has powers in this film?
No, and like when we get later in the movie, it just seems like Dracula can kind of dish him out to people willy-nilly. Because, you know, we get to a point that like some people it's getting into spoiler territory, but you know, some people get powers, some people just don't get to die, but do they get powers? You know, who knows? And yeah, that was a bit wishy-washy, where like I almost thought that like it was the thing that like you have to do a certain ceremony, or you know, do something to become Renfield, to become, you know, this familiar and get this power. And then when it kind of just got passed to someone else, and then multiple people then got it as well, I was like, oh, this is strange.
Like, yeah, okay, I'm definitely, yeah, I'm definitely a bit confused on that. And because yeah, within Shadows, like, it's the familiars are just their, you know, doting servants, yeah, and they purely do it because of the wish of one day they will bite them and let them become a vampire.
Yeah,
that's, and that's like the whole reason.
That's like, I didn't have the term in my head, but that's definitely been in stuff that I've seen before.
Yeah, where a human that works for the vampire.
It was in like American Horror Story, weren't it?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, where you've got these like zombie-like people that want to become vampires, but they don't let them, and they just
There's loads in Blade as well.
Yeah, you know, and that's kind of what it is, you know, and it's like, yeah, they don't get powers; they become less than human instead of more than human, you know, because of what's happened to them.
Yeah, and it's all for that wish. It's almost like they're just the biggest fanboys, where they're like, oh, I'll do anything for that promise of one day. And it's almost like the vampires know as well, where they're like, yeah, I can just keep stringing along this idiot for as long as possible. Yeah. Because like I say, there's so many limitations on vampires in a lot of media. Like, typically they have to be in a coffin all day. So it's like, okay, you can do all my shit during the day, basically. Yeah. But yeah, back to this film. I had a good time with it. I thought, like, to start with, as my kind of overall thoughts, like, I think with a lot of films, it is all about expectations versus reality. And I feel like I've always had the right level of expectation for this film, pretty much from the moment it was announced, and then certainly when we first saw footage from it, where I was like, okay, I get what this is. Like, this isn't going to shatter anyone's world. It's going to be just this dumb, goofy, fun vampire film. And sort of being a big fan of two of the actors, especially, like, I kind of thought, like, okay, that's going to carry this film. And it definitely did. Because I could easily see a world where, you know, if the two Nicks aren't in this, I probably wouldn't have enjoyed it. But they were, and that's the film I'm reviewing. And I had a good time with it because of them. I thought that their interactions with each other were great, especially Nicholas Holt throughout the whole film. I thought he was brilliant again. I think that the first half's definitely better. I think what we see in the trailer does a really good job of kind of showing off what this film is, and they're kind of centered around this self-help group, which is a great concept. Like, even as someone who isn't familiar with Renfield until this film, I think that's such a, like, a genius sort of juxtapositioning of a familiar who is tied to a vampire, obviously in this case being Count Dracula, you know, the most famous vampire and the most famous familiar, but becoming this almost abusive relationship, and him going to this self-help group. And I love that initially it is to track down the sort of abusive spouses of these people from the group, to use as victims for Dracula. I was like, oh, that was really good. And I loved all that early stuff. And there's some really good jokes in there as well early on. And then him actually becoming, you know, more self-aware and more sort of believing in himself and all of that stuff, and his sort of transformation as a character throughout the film, I think, is all centered around the self-help group, which works really well. So yeah, I definitely thought the first half was better, because that's when you get a lot of you're introduced into the character. I think it starts really fun, because we kind of get like a lot of jump through history and showing like their first meeting in this like old school style way. It just starts great. Really well.
Yeah, looked great in that as well. I was like, man,
yeah,
I almost wanted him to be like a serious Dracula when I saw that.
You're absolutely
right. I was like, fuck, he looks the part. Like, he looked a lot like Christopher Lee. I felt like just embodied that. And I was like, damn, like, I want that movie now.
He really did. And I think that is probably something that's unfortunate about this film, is that it's weird to live in a world now where it's like, okay, now we see him do serious Dracula, because it would feel weird doing it in this order. But I agree with you that, like, he's very funny, like he always is when he wants to be. But he's also very scary and very menacing, and has that screen presence of Dracula that you'd want. So yeah, I think he would have been like, he works in just so many different styles, and it's clear as day in this film as well that, like, yeah, he can do comedy, and that's what this film asked for. But say, for instance, he's in, you know, Robert Eggers' Nosferatu, I'm sure he would be exceptional in that, which just shows you how sort of amazing his range is as an actor. But yeah, first half is great, and I think it really flies past. It's just so quick firing. There's just a lot of really good jokes, a lot of good action. It definitely slows down dramatically in the middle. There's a sort of giant side plot involving like some gangsters and the police force, and it's fine. I didn't hate it, but it's so obviously a B plot. When you look at the name of this film, who's in it, the poster, like everything about this movie is the relationship between Renfield and Dracula. And it unfortunately has a lot in the film that isn't that. You know, I predicted that I kind of said, like, yeah, I really think Nick Cage is not going to be in this film a lot. And again, I think that's why my expectations were set perfectly for this film, because he's in it quite a bit.
I was going to say, yeah, more than I thought.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's why that I came out of this being happy with how much Nick Cage we got.
Yeah.
But if you know nothing about this and just hear that he's playing Dracula and see the poster, you could easily be disappointed, because you're like, well, I'm watching this whole buddy cop film and this gangster side plot that has nothing to do with Dracula throughout most of the film. Of course it ties into him eventually, but yeah. And then I think by the end of it tied together pretty well. Like, even though I preferred the first half because of the relationship between Renfield and Dracula, and obviously once you kind of get the self-help stuff in, and as you alluded to, him kind of wanting to break away from Dracula, it becomes less interesting, I think, because it is just more of an adversarial thing of like, you know, good versus evil, basically, at that point. And it works, and it was fun, and it was a satisfying conclusion, and it didn't overstay its welcome. But yeah, I think the first half was really good, and I still enjoyed it overall. I just don't know how they would have kept that energy because of the plot of the film, I guess. Is like, I don't know how the self-help stuff works so well to set up who these characters are. But then, unfortunately, it does have to be about other things. Like, once Renfield needs to take control of his life again, I don't know how they could have done it better than they did, I guess. So I don't have any answers other than, like, it just wasn't as good for me as the first half. But yeah, still had a lot of fun with it. It's nothing sort of earth-shattering. I kind of put this, like, maybe slightly better than, like, a sort of cocaine beer level, where I'm like, yeah, this was a good time that I'm probably never going to think about in a few weeks. But yeah, had a good time watching it.
Yeah, I think I definitely like this movie less than you. I think for me, when the movie was first announced was when I was most like on board with this movie as a concept. I heard the concept, heard the cast, was high on Nicolas Cage at that point, and was like, yeah, I want this. And then when I saw the trailer, and I kind of, it was exactly what I thought it was going to be. But when I saw it, I was like, I don't know if I want this that much. And then, like, when I watched this movie, I was like, the trailer was better than the movie, because the trailer just showed all of the first half. And because the movie is incredibly geared towards the first half. It feels like a short that had a start and an end, and they had to put in a big middle. Because the gangster stuff and all of that made no sense. The mum and the gangster, and like, and then like, we haven't even got into the cop and like her sister and her dead dad and all of this just like side plot that just makes no sense. And we don't care, because we care about Dracula and Renfield. And yeah, so all of that was frustrating. Also the fact that this movie kind of, you know, it goes there at times with the violence. And some of it is just like abysmal CG, like real bad. And I think, like, you know, we've got to a point where I think really bad CG needs to be called out, because
especially with this budget as well.
Yeah. Well, because there's two things. That first of all, we see movies with no budget that do it practical. And we don't stop calling that out. That, like, when like, how many horrors did we watch last year where we were like, man, it's hard because we're desensitized to it, but like the gore in that movie was gnarly and it would look so good. And it's like, yeah. And then you see a movie with this sort of budget and you're like, this looks trash. Like, there was so many scenes where, like, obviously, like, when Renfield gets his powers, and he's, like, ripping limbs off. And there's one in particular where he's, like, ripped limbs off and he's then got, like, two arms that he's using as a weapon. And it's, like, that's over the top and silly. And I'm not against that. You know, that could have been, you know, what it was going for. It was almost like, the Peter Jackson movie.
Brain Dead.
Or Evil Dead, you know, where it's just like, you know, slapsticky and over the top and silly fun. But it was like, just let him hold a prosthetic arm. Like put some practical effects on it. Because it just felt like he was holding two bits of green. And then it just there was this splurt and blood CG. And it just didn't look good. And it really took me out of the silly, zany fun that they were going for. Because we get to a point that it is Renfield versus a load of gangsters. And it's like, oh, okay, this is just going to be like your John Wick kind of moment where like he's just like tearing up shit and it's going to be this fun action sequence. And I just felt like it missed the mark so much because of the way it looked.
Yeah.
And if they'd have just made it a bit more practical or got the CG better, just whatever it was to make it not look as bad, I would have had a dumb fun time seeing him just rip limbs off and then use them as a projectile. I'm like, okay, that's fun if it doesn't look trash.
Yeah. I just want to mention that and then I'll throw it back to you because I agree with you completely. And it's a shame because on paper, it's really fun. And I still had a good time with some of those scenes because it is funny where he's like, yeah, it's a John Wick style fighting sequence, but he's literally punching people's heads off. And like, that's hilarious and would be fun. And I get that that's ridiculously hard to all do practical. But the problem is that, yeah, it's all CG and it is bad. And I think the my biggest issue with it is I think blood has always looked shit in CG.
It's got worse. Like, when this movie Rob out on it for like rejects. Man, I wish blood still looked like that, CG.
But yeah, like you say, with this, because it's these huge gushing explosions, whether it's arms, legs, or heads being ripped off, it looks terrible. And especially, obviously, we just saw Evil Dead that did it right, where it's like it's all practical and has like... And I think one thing that for me that is so noticeable is when the room fills with blood... And then a split second later, the character looks completely normal and dry. And like, that's one thing that I always loved about like all of the Evil Dead movies is you always get that blood stained skin of the characters.
Yeah, you get some good blood continuity.
Yeah, and like Nicholas Hoult is basically dry throughout the whole film, even though he's literally ripping off arms and using them as weapons, and there is blood everywhere, but then within a second, there's no blood. So that was, yeah, I agree with you. And to mention, like, the budget's $65 million, so there's no excuse here. Like, you've got the budget, just use it better. Because, yeah, like, there isn't too much in this film that would require a budget. There isn't, like, huge car chases or... Anything else other than the fight sequences would cost money, so you have to do them well, and they don't really.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that is the thing that at its best it was as good as its trailer, and it never exceeded that for me. And there were some good laughs in it, and you know, it was just all. I feel like as well, it was just the wrong time for me to watch this movie. I felt not in the mood for this particular comedy, which is weird because I chose to watch like other comedies this week instead that worked. But this one for me just, yeah, it didn't really like scratch that comedic itch. And then, you know, the horror wasn't there because the gore looked bad. So then it was just like, oh, okay, do I like the story? And I'm like, well, I enjoyed the Renfield Dracula side of the story, but very strongly disliked the rest.
Mm.
So at that point, it really starts to get chipped away at, where I'm like, oh, okay, like I don't think I had high expectations as well. Like, I think I was into the idea when first announced, but like I said, ever since the first announcement, I've gotten less and less excited for this movie, even though it was delivering exactly what it promised. You know, there was never a point where the movie took a curveball and I was like, oh, I weren't expecting that. Like, if anything, it gave me like more Nick Cage than I kind of expected.
I guess the thing is that they could have this could have been more serious. Because of the especially with the self-help group thing, like there's a lot of serious topics there, and you can bring in like real life serious issues. And I think that that kind of juxtapositions with who Renfield is. Like they could do an amazing job of really humanizing who he is and being like, here's how I fell into this trap of Dracula, and here's how I'm trying to break out of it. And yeah, you could have had some jokes in there, but I do think that obviously they wanted to make a complete laugh out loud comedy. That's what they were going for, an absurdist kind of comedy with the gore as well. And especially like the subplot, like the gangsters and stuff like that, is just a pure comedy subplot. There's nothing in that that's like remotely serious. But yeah, on paper, and especially with these actors, like as what we've seen, like I mean Nicholas Holt, like in The Menu, like his acting chops in that, and how like emotional he kind of the emotional reaction he gets, I think was just so astonishing. Like it's still one of my favorite acting performances of the year was him specifically in The Menu. And like
also his comedic timing in that movie.
Yeah.
Like, you know, was also really, really great. And especially when that's not overtly a comedy. So when this is like being an over the top comedy, and I'm like, oh, he's got great awkward timing. Like brilliant.
Yeah, and it's like, and he, don't get me wrong, like, he's hilarious in this film, and I really enjoyed him, but yeah, I would rather him be able to do something a bit more nuanced, because I think we've seen, like you say, we got comedy, but we got other stuff in his other performance, whereas I just basically got comedy. And yeah, he did do a few cool sort of emotional beats, but that's just not what this film is at all. And obviously that was the intent, but yeah, that was just, it is a missed opportunity, I think, that they could have made it more serious, like you say, that rather than just be a comedy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we get into, like, the you know, the police side and everything else, like, it was throwing a lot in the blender as well, you know, because we've got, like, this entirely corrupt police force. We have one police officer in the entire precinct that's trying to do good. And it's one where, like, you can see that it's, you know, when we talk about a movie being a full-on comedy, it then gets quite often passes for being dumb. And it's like, dumb doesn't mean funny. And like with the police, it was like, well, that's just dumb that like, she's there, the only person in that police force, and everyone around her is corrupt. It's like, well, that's just a pointless character that's never going to achieve what she wants to achieve because she's fucked. Like, you know, there's no way she can win. And it just kind of felt like a bit, you know, frustrating. And, you know, but I think, you know, definitely where this movie's strong point is in that self-help group. And like you say, those kind of self-reflecting talks that Renfield makes and kind of, I really enjoyed the scene when he got like his apartment and was like trying to rebuild his life and dressing different and like discovering a comb and all of those things, just, you know, that was like the comedy that worked the strongest in the movie for me. And then there were some really good Nick Cage moments as well, you know, and even like, you know, he managed to pull off some decent horror moments as well, like, because he really did look the part, I thought.
Definitely.
And like, if this had been a serious horror movie, I feel like he could have scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
Like, because he is a weird dude, you know, and so put the weird dude in a Dracula get up, like, and you're going to get some weird results, and it doesn't necessarily need to be funny. And yeah, it's a weird one where like, I've warmed to funny Nick Cage over the years and now want that. And having this movie where I'm like, oh, I kind of would have liked a serious Nick Cage in this one. Like it could have been, like I said, him being in a serious Dracula role, like dark as fuck, like, the opening scene, I was like, damn, that's what I want.
Yeah, like, but his physical acting in this, I thought, was exceptional, where, like, he really, the kind of the tightness of the shoulders going up into the neck and kind of the hunched round, and they did so many cool things where he'll be talking with his back to the camera and he'll sort of slowly turn round with like the shadow on his face. And yeah, there's so much good shit there that, like, if you just watched, you know, like the supercut of Nick Cage in this film, you'd be like, god, this film's exceptional.
The credits, when this film rolls, like, the credits almost replay like a greatest hits of the movie.
Yeah.
And a lot of Nick Cage stuff, but like with a black and white filter on it. And it made the movie darker because obviously you don't get to hear the comedy. So you're just getting the visuals of the movie. And like, I watched those credits thinking like, fuck, I enjoyed that movie. Like, that's my movie I just watched. Like, when are they making that short into a feature? And I was like, oh yeah, I just watched it.
Yeah.
Like, it was strange. And yeah, I didn't dislike this movie by no stretch of the imagination, but this just isn't one that, like, was funny enough to cleanse my palate and wasn't serious enough to, like, make me care about it in a horror sense. So it just kind of sat in the middle and was very okay to good.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. Like I said, I definitely enjoyed it a bit more, but it is... I will definitely have, I guess, a lingering disappointment in the coming months when I look back on Renfield, because I'm like, oh, that could have been something awesome. And I know we say that quite a lot, but it is true that, like, it's going to be one of those ones that, yeah, you can enjoy a film, but it can also be so much lesser than it could have been.
Yeah.
And it is a shame because, yeah, you have such an exceptional duo here that are perfectly cast, like, exceptionally cast. And that's such a good start. If you have a duo of actors that are perfectly fit for the roles, it's hard to not look at the other aspects of the film and be disappointed. I think as well, with you mentioning, like, the end credits thing and the kind of black and white filter, like, the visual style of this movie isn't great. Like the actual film. Like, we mentioned it in seeing the trailer, but this kind of, like, blue hue that the movie has, it's so weird because that is purely in what we do in the shadows, and it doesn't bother me in that show because it's the only show I can think of that looks like that. So I'm like, oh yeah, that's just their style. But it's very weird for because I've not seen that in any other, you know, vampire thing. So it's weird for this movie to come out that also has a familiar and stuff to take that, in my opinion, cheap looking TV style, which works because it's a cheaply made TV show that I have a lot of fun with, take that to a big screen cinema experience, because I'm like, this just looks kind of shit. And again, I think it's purposely shit. Like, even not to go on too much, but, like, What We Do in the Shadows is supposed to be like a mockumentary.
Yeah, it's like Monsters, you know, or that sort of thing, you know. It's like, yeah, they've chosen that visual style.
Yeah, there's an in-universe reason for why it looks crap as well, because it's supposed to be like you're catching the vampires when you're not supposed to see them a lot of the times, whereas this is like, no, like, none of that's valid here. And it's like, why does it look the same? It's like, yeah, we just like that style and we stole it. And it's like, well, one, that's a terrible reason anyway, and two, you did it poorer, and three, it doesn't fit a film either. Like, and it was a detriment to your film as well, because the scenes, like what you mentioned, when we see Renfield buying the apartment and stuff, when they go away from that shitty blue hue, are, like, so much better. It just makes the movie look so much better when they don't do that. So it is weird. But yeah, I guess before we do to, like, the final closing thoughts, there was one thing that did pop into my head when I was sort of reading this, is that, do you remember, like, in the news a few weeks ago when we talked about the new Radio Silence movie, which is a sort of upcoming Universal Monsters film?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And obviously in that article, it said, like, based upon the two recent hits of The Invisible Man and Renfield, and I joked at the time being like, well, that's kind of weird because the movie's not even out yet for Renfield, you know, calling it a hit. Well, this movie has a budget of $65 million, and it made $24 million at the box office. So I don't know how, in what universe, you could call this movie a hit.
We said that almost like they wanted to create their own narrative, and yeah, maybe it was tracking okay, and like was like, oh yeah, we're probably going to do quite well, and then only the people that like, you know, pre-book seats actually went to see it, and they got no additional income from it. Because yeah, when you read that for the Radio Silence kind of announcement, it felt premature to call Renfield a success, and that's clearly what's been proven. So yeah, that they were very much saw the writing on the wall and created the narrative early pre-release.
Yeah, like I remember calling that at the time, and obviously I didn't harp on it too much because it hadn't come out yet, but it was weird. And because I think that was Deadline as well, which is, it's surprising that they said that, but then it might have been a case of them kind of them pulling from the Universal statement, you know, announcing the upcoming Radio Silence movie and then kind of adapting it. So it might have been a case of them just pulling from that and being like, oh well, if Universal says it's a hit, then of course it is. But yeah, that was weird anyway. But yeah, I guess, you know, final I guess recommendations, you can go first. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I'd say probably not, like, because ultimately, when I'm recommending movies for the podcast, I recommend them on the horror side as well. And so, yeah, I don't think this movie is strong enough for, like, I wouldn't say it's a huge avoid, but I certainly don't recommend it.
Yeah, I would slightly edge more towards recommending it, because I had a good time with it, and it's definitely not a cinema watch, and it's certainly a, you know, watch at home and potentially wait until it's on a service that you already subscribe to. I think in terms of like the time commitment, in terms of whether you'll get enjoyment out of it, like say, yeah, there's going to be so many better horror films, or hopefully, but I think for the fun value and for like the Nick Cage and Nicholas Holt value that I got out of it, then I would recommend it. But yeah, there's like a huge asterisk to it, because it's like, well, if you like Renfield and Dracula, that's cool, but you have to be mindful of what we mentioned in our main review, which is that there is huge parts of this film that don't tick that box, and they're not only are they not very good, they have almost nothing to do with horror.
They add nothing to the movie, to the horror, or to the comedy. They just add to the runtime.
Yeah, it's like, well, we just got this. So I think when the credits start, it was bang on 89 minutes, and I was like, man, you guys did well. Because there is a good 50 minutes of great Renfield and Dracula stuff in here. But unfortunately, it is almost like 50-50 with some dross. So yeah, pretty mixed review, I'd say, on that one, which seems to be the general consensus of this film. According to Wikipedia, it has very mixed reviews. So this one, apparently we're with the critics, as opposed to last week, which that little movie that had stunning sound design. I'm not over it. I'm still thinking about it.
I'd forgotten about that. I really had. Like, don't bring up, oh man, I've just got so angry so instantly.
Yes, that was my intention.
There's not many movies that can trigger like that level of anger in me that soon, because quite often I tend to just laugh about it, you know, move on, because I don't try to get triggered by it. I don't want to focus on the hate. But yeah, that movie does sense like that does like create anger instantly when I think about it.
Stunning sound design. That's the quote. That's
TCM.
That is literally the quote. Like that, if I think back to this year in horror, I'm just going to think of stunning sound design for sure. But yeah, that was our discussion on Renfield. We will take a quick break and we will be right back. So yeah, that's pretty much it for another week. I did actually have a couple of films that I want to just very briefly discuss, because I've been watching some weird shit lately. I've watched loads of stuff that isn't horror, which of course I won't mention, but I just this was basically over the last sort of month or two where I'm like, oh, I've watched quite a few movies I can just quickly touch upon. The first one I really don't have too much to add, because everyone already knows how amazing this movie is, but it's Jaws. First time watching it in quite a while.
Anyone heard of Jaws?
Yeah, a little movie you might have heard of, which, yeah, I've seen so many times over the years, and I've been lucky enough to see it at the cinema, and it's great. This was the first time watching it on 4K. I would say the 4K is not exceptional. Like, the movie looks great, and it has, like, a whole special feature about the transfer, and, like, Steven Spielberg being involved and stuff, but I'm almost certain that was when it got ported, you know, the Blu-ray transfer. And I feel like this was very much like, yeah, just like upscale it, because it was one of the only 4Ks I've watched that hasn't blown me away yet. But it's weird, because I also think that it looks great. It's just, I don't know, there's something about it where I'm like, this feels like I've just bought a Blu-ray on a 4K disc, which I was fine with. And of course, the movie's exceptional. And then, yeah, a couple of movies. Again, that's the newest of the four that I've watched recently, in 1975. Right. The rest are all either 50s or 60s.
Jesus Christ, you have been on a fucking rabbit hole.
Yeah, I like watching.
I don't know. I do find Jaws funny, because as a movie, whenever I think about Jaws, I never hold it in like high regard in my mind.
Oh, the best ever.
No, let me get there. Because it's one that I never watched much, like growing up or anything. And I remember as well, like, we had like the sequels on like VHS, like recordings of like Jaws 2 and Jaws 3 and shit. So like they all kind of blended in my head, and I'm like, oh, is this the one where there's all like the fucking yacht stranded out to sea and he's picking them off, and I'm like, oh no, that's like,
see, that's so weird, because I have zero memory of watching any. I don't think I've ever seen any of the sequels.
No, I do. That's weird that you haven't. But like, yeah, I remember watching like tons of the sequels, and I've got like a lot of the sequels in my head. That and so awful. it is so that's why. But then when I do on occasion, like, I've got a weird Blu-ray of Jaws, which is like a book. It was like Universal's, like, they were doing it for all of their movies, yeah, like this weird like book style one, and I've got that, and I remember like buying it and then slapping it on and being like, fuck, this movie is great. Like, you can see why it's regarded as, you know, a masterpiece, because obviously the director is a, you know, is a genius, and you know, the work shows. And I think you know, and a horror movie, because I think I again, with the sequels in mind, I'm like, well, they're closer to like, you know, these zany Sharknado movies and that sort of thing, and I can see how that got spawned from those, and that's what I have in my head that Jaws is. And yeah, sometimes I have to remind myself that there's this fucking banger that exists and all this other trash around it.
Yeah, it's undoubtedly still one of the best horrors ever made. And yeah, it'll always be my favorite Spielberg movie for sure. But yeah, kind of from one amazing director to another, these two first time watchers. Oh,
not Jurassic Park with those dinosaurs, bro.
Yeah. Let's not derail. yeah, kind of. I picked up this like Hitchcock collection on 4K. So I've been trying to, yeah, because like it's Hitchcock's to me one of the weirdest ones in terms of how little of his filmography I've seen, because like Psycho might be my favorite horror movie ever. Like, I really don't know what it is, but that's easily top five, and always has been. And so it's wild to me that, of course, he's not known for horror, very similar to Spielberg. So it's kind of, but he does have like horror adjacent-y stuff. And he obviously did a lot of thrillers, and I'd argue that these two that I've seen are either, well, the first one's definitely not a horror movie, which is Vertigo, which, yeah, from 1958. Ooh. And I didn't really like this one. Like, it's really long. It's like over 2 hours. I think it was like 2 hours and 15, and it's the concept I love. You know, I've always been fascinated by and hearing about the title, and that's very much how I learned what Vertigo was from this film. And like, it starts, and you kind of get him getting vertigo because he's like chasing this robber on a roof, and like, I think it's his partner in the police force, or you know, dies, and so he kind of has this panic attack, and you're like, oh, that's really cool. And then it just becomes a romance film, and this love story, and that's pretty much the rest of the film until one other scene towards the end where the vertigo kicks in again. And so yeah, I was pretty disappointed with this one, which is a shame, because yeah, I've just heard such great things for a while. But again, I'm giving you my my first take on a movie which is 65 years old, which is always fun. Yeah, so people have been waiting a long time for that one. And then yeah, speaking of, oh, this one's just a sort of, this one's so new because this one was 1963, is The Birds, which again, from seeing Psycho for so long, I've always wanted to watch The Birds, and I've obviously seen clips of it a lot because it always features in a lot of these horror countdowns. I'm pretty sure it was in that Shudder thing we watched last year, and it just always features. But like, again, I didn't know what the overall plot was or anything like that, and I loved this film. This was awesome. I loved the characters. Again, it's weird because it's also a romance film, like at the heart of it, which again, I love seeing this context to Psycho, because again, I love Psycho, but I feel like it gives you this extra context that's probably what audiences were expecting. You know, they thought it would be this romance movie because she's obviously, you know, sleeping with the guy at the start, and they're going to run off together, and it obviously goes wrong after she steals the money for their new life. So I love that then it becomes this weird horror movie about this guy who's obsessed with his mom. Like, it's so crazy to think about that.
Yeah, it's funny how dark Psycho gets when you look at kind of his other filmography.
Definitely, like, and it's like, crazy.
Yeah, how that must have fucked, because, yeah, like, you know, someone that's not seen many Hitchcock movies, I'm like, oh, yeah, Hitchcock has got to be up there with, like, these masters of horror. I'm like, no, he made... he made one movie that, that turned into a horror movie at the end, but it just was super fucked up, and especially for when it came out.
Yeah, you know, and I think so. The Birds is very, you know, I think he is close to being a horror film. It's certainly a thriller, and I think they were the intention was to scare people. And it is just mind blowing. Like, of course, a lot of it people will laugh at sort of nowadays, but I was fascinated by like the craft of it. You know, coming from 1963, and you can't help but think about someone like him just being born in like a different era. Because he's obviously like one of the all-time greats, no question about it, but you just think like what he was doing in the 50s and 60s is ridiculous, because he's doing shit that is like he's inventing the wheel didn't exist before him. And so, you know, of course,
yeah, he got sent back in time.
I think
that's the answer to the question.
It does feel that way, but doesn't, like, it, when you see these people where it's like, you're a time traveler, you're just cheating, because you clearly knew all these techniques. There's no way you could be the one guy that invented them all. You know, we see these auteurs like Kubrick making 2001 when he did, is just like, no, you didn't do this, you're lying. Like, you watched Interstellar and then you went back 50 years and made a better film. Like, it's crazy. But The Birds was great. It's fascinating as well, because I'd watched Jaws like the week before, and again not knowing much about The Birds, I had no idea that like The Birds heavily inspired Jaws. Like the entire thing is like it's set on this seaside resort that's getting terrorized, and they're like, they're shutting the town down and the beach and stuff. I'm like, oh, it's crazy how much Spielberg was doing his take on The Birds but with a shark. So it made me love both the movies. So, yeah, I'd highly recommend this one. It was awesome. And then the last one, again, a super old film, but this one's so weird, because I have seen this movie many times, from 1966. It's so, so weird, because, like, I have such nostalgia for this, and I don't think you do. Maybe you do. Which
I was too busy watching the Jaws sequels, mate.
Yeah, clearly. but yeah, I was watching Carry On Screaming.
Oh, Christ. Yeah, what a banger.
I was going to say, do you like this movie? Because I fucking love it.
Night. What an absolute banger.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I
love it.
Like, to give a bit of background context on this one, because I feel like this is one
of the few Carry On movies that we saw a lot as like, fairly young.
Yeah, so to give a backstory, because I'm, you know, we have a lot of international listeners, and I'm sure people outside of Britain aren't going to be fully aware of what these films are. The Carry On franchise, there was 30 films that they released in the late 50s to, I believe, the late 70s. So 30 films in like a 20-year span. So they were doing one or two a year. And they were massively popular in Britain. And the Carry On series is like each film is different, like an anthology sort of, but it had a sort of returning cast of characters.
Well, and those returning casts of characters would always play this of type,
yeah,
as well, which was what made it funny.
Exactly.
That you choose. As soon as that face popped up, it wasn't like an American Horror Story where it was like, oh, what's Evan Peters going to be this season? It was like, oh no, was it Sid James?
Yeah, Sid James, yeah.
It was like, oh yeah, there's Sid James. Okay, we know what that character's going to be then. Like, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This wasn't like, oh, I'm gonna play three different characters in this year. It's like, no, they always played the exact same character. But what made this movie special is that, yeah, the Carry On franchise is basically like a lewd comedy. It's a lot of sexual innuendo, and it's all about like these dumb idiot men trying to have sex with women. That's like basically the plot of every film. But it always centers around either a location or a profession, and that's kind of just the only thing they remix. And it's, other than that, it's the same jokes and it's the same good time. But what made Carry On Screaming so unique is that it was a horror film. It still had all those trappings of a Carry On film, and it still has like a lead character who's in an unhappy marriage and he's trying to have sex with other women. That's like the lead detective in this film. But it was their take on Hammer horror. And so you have like an Addams Family kind of archetype, that are the main being like a Morticia Addams and a Lurch character. But then you have a Frankenstein, you have multiple werewolf characters in it as well. And it
was like more of the lesser known actors in this one as well, wasn't it?
Like, yeah, so it, you know, like the big ones, like,
you don't get, like, Barbara Windsor.
No, so the two you've mentioned, like Sid James and Barbara Windsor, who are arguably like the two sort of biggest names in Carry On, they're not in this. And yeah, it was a lot of the smaller characters who are, exceptional. Because yeah, it is hilarious, and it's got all those trappings. Oh. You know, it's got all of those conventions of a Carry On film, but it is a horror film. You know, it's about like this woman who gets kidnapped, and then she gets like turned into a model in a shop, and so it's got this like House of Wax vibes as well. Like, it's got so much cool shit in it. And yeah, I'm glad you have nostalgia for this as well, because for me, this is one of the most nostalgia things I could ever watch. Because again, talking about those early films that you watched that kind of made you think about films in a different light, I watched this at like a ludicrously young age, and so both levels hit massively. The kind of lewd jokes were like, oh, I'm watching something that I shouldn't be watching, like that hit massively. Yeah. And then like the horror, which now is obviously like laughable, but back then was genuinely scary, seeing like a guy turn into a werewolf.
When that came out, it was comparable.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that would have come out in the 60s.
Yeah, 66.
Right?
Like, yeah, so it was in the height of it.
Yeah. So it was like, you weren't watching like fucking Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Mm. You know, like, this was like, you know, fairly out there for like the horror that was being produced. And yeah, I'm angry that you've mentioned it, because now all I want to do is watch that fucking movie. Because yeah, I haven't seen this movie in 20 plus years. Probably. Yeah. And yeah, I know the second I watch it, I'd have an absolute blast.
You have to. Like, I've been saving it for a rainy day, because I feel like it's been at least 15 years since I saw it. And it was one that, yeah, it was on rotation a lot as a child. And yeah, seeing this in like HD for the first time, it looked great as well. So,
well, it's funny because, yeah, this was 100% a VHS recording that we had. Mm-hmm. Like, recorded off TV, probably had a Jaws movie at the end of it. and you know, because I'm not even sure whether... Did we have... Like, I don't even know if we had the full movie.
It's like, weird, because the opening scene is the guy going on the date with the girl, and that's when she kind of gets taken at the start. And so I do remember that scene, but I feel like it did start in the middle of that scene.
Or maybe we just didn't have the end fully, I don't know. Like, God knows. But, you know, back then, especially with, like, people that didn't grow up in the VHS world, where it was, like, long play and short play and, like, turn the tape the other way and, like, all of this shit, it was, like, Jesus Christ, like, yeah, how are we... And, like, trying to catalog that shit. And then being like, yeah, I've got 16 movies on this like VHS.
Yeah.
You know, and then trying to like add more on it, but then fucking it up and losing one because you've got your timings wrong. Like, it was chaos.
Yeah. I think that's a good point, because that is part of the story of this film, where it was
the fun, like, back
yeah,
then.
Like, it's a shame that you can't go back and change it now and be like, I'd love to have more of these memories, because I feel like you will run out of them. Where we've talked at length about like The Hills of Eyes Part 2 and how sort of seminal that was, and it's crazy that this hasn't really been brought up before, because this was massive in terms of watching a quote unquote horror film. But obviously, this is still very comedy. This isn't watching The Hills of Eyes as a child.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, is that because like, we were in a household where the Carry On films were on, so then this was just on because of that. So therefore, it was
a gateway for sure.
Oh shit, we're getting a glimpse into horror. Like, those movies are wild as well. Just thinking about all of them. Yeah. Like, if there's like overseas listeners that haven't seen them, like, those movies are so wild because they are like one of the most time and a place thing ever. Like, because every movie is incredibly inappropriate with. Yeah, like you say, it's basically just dudes trying to get laid, like in inappropriate ways, using their jobs of power to influence women. You know, all of these like horrific things that have come to light in latter years that this movie was, you know, just putting on the big screen. Yeah. It's crazy.
Oh yeah, it's always like, it's older married men typically as well, where they're always like, oh, I'm away from the
in a job of
power. And it'll always be like, oh, the old ball and chains at home, so what she don't know don't harm her, and stuff like that. Like, it's wild that's
well, because
premise.
The wife was always the same actress, weren't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because like, she's amazing in this film. Like, she's so funny as like the pissed off wife at home. And like, I love the lead detective, like his constant jokes, like, it's just
he's
it's amazing. Like, I love this film so much. much. And I'm so glad I rewatched it. And yeah, I want you to rewatch it so we can just talk about it again on the podcast, because it's so great. Like, it's so underrated, and it's, you don't take this as a recommendation, because I don't know what anyone would think about watching this for the first time with no context. Just watching again, you need to know what Carry On movies is, because this is the outlier in the Carry On franchise, and that's what made it so fascinating to me. But yeah, it was such a good time. So yeah, I've had a great time really with all these, even though like Vertigo was disappointing. I'm glad I watched it. I think it's Rear Window is the last one I have on 4K to watch, which again, like, I know all about Rear Window, and obviously we've seen, basically there's been like 10 different remakes that aren't even remakes. Because there's the Shia LaBeouf one. I can't remember what that's called now, where he's like spying on the neighbors and they witness a murder. And obviously, even like Summer of, was it 84? Is that what it was? That's very similar.
Is it 84 or 85?
I can't remember. 85 now you said it sounds right, but I don't, oh God, that's annoying me.
It's 84.
Right. But yeah, like that whole convention has been used a million times now. And so that'll be interesting, because it's like, oh no, I'm watching the original one. So yeah, I'll look forward to that. Watch Carry On screaming. It's a great time.
I mean, I really want to, I'm not going to lie.
That can be our next retrospective.
Yeah, the Carry On movies.
Yeah. All 30, and only one of them's a horror.
Only one of them's kind of a horror.
Yeah. And I love how they're the most, like, they're all the same. Like, that's what's great about this.
I know, that's what's great about it. Like I want to do a spin-off. Like, when we set up a Patreon or something, one of our peers will be the Carry On spin-off, because it is, like, I do want to review Terminator 2 candidly every week.
I'll be one of them.
And yeah, that's definitely going
to
be one
It'll
of them.
It'll be the goal to see how we can actually hate that film if we have to talk about it every week.
Yeah, like, how many weeks would it take until I'm like, I don't want to watch Terminator 2 this week? You know, like, when would that actually happen? Because I'm doing it most weeks with my own free will.
Yeah, I'd be scared how many years it would take. And I'm definitely saying in the years as well.
Yeah, like, how many podcasts, what number are we on?
347.
Yeah, we'd get there.
Probably, because if you think about the mean...
Over the years, you know what I mean? If you were to say, do that in the next, like, year, watch it daily, yeah, I might get a bit bored of it. But over the next, like, 6 or 7 years... watch Terminator another 300 times, like, cool.
Yeah, if you think about the mean of doing this podcast, we've seen amazing movies, but we've seen a bunch of dog shit ones as well, and that is more taxing. Exactly. So yeah, I think consistently, even though obviously we've not seen any films that are better than Terminator 2, but Terminator 2 will not have the same value watching it every single week. It will have diminishing returns.
Would we be allowed to watch, like, different versions?
That's interesting, yeah.
You know, be like, oh, let's actually hook up a video. Like, and watch a VHS of Terminator 2. Let's watch the Blu-ray. Let's watch the DVD. Let's watch the extended.
Let's watch it when we haven't slept for 1 week.
Yeah, you know, just all these different variables. Like, you know, I think it could be a goer. Like, and especially, you know, we're almost done with the Wes retrospective. Yeah. I'm just throwing that in there.
I love the amount of, like, absolute bullshit ideas that we've said on the podcast. Like, well, this is going to replace Wes. And then we're like, well, we can never end this thing now. Because otherwise we'd have to start on the Carry On films.
Well, so, because you fucking know how dead set I am on watching Terminator every few weeks.
I know. Like, I love that. That's where I'm like, well, I guess I'm watching the Carry On films, because that's actually a better idea.
No, it's not, dude. No, it's not.
Neither of them are horror films.
Hey, Terminator 1's a horror film.
Yeah. Oh dear. All right, I think that's it for another week.
We're still doing the podcast.
Yeah, that's it. Like, of course, you've definitely broke the record now. Like, I was taking the piss with Psycho Goreman for a while. And like, but like,
what do you mean?
Because like, Terminator 2 has really come back in vogue on this podcast in 2023. I feel like you calmed it down for a while. Like,
well, no, because genuinely, it's how much I watch it.
Yeah, but you took that away from the podcast for a couple of years at least.
A bit, but I probably was watching it less.
Yeah.
And just in recent times, I felt a need for it, like that comfort food.
Yeah.
And just be like, You know, I just want
something. I can always tell by how engaged you are with modern current films by how much you're watching Terminator 2. And I don't think it goes well currently.
There is a direct correlation, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I'm watching zero fucking television, zero like other like non-horror movies, and the horror movies are dried up. So yeah, of course I'm thinking of watching the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
I was gonna say enjoy TV while you can, because I didn't really put it in the news because I couldn't be bothered. It's such a bummer. But like the current writer's strike is gonna have such a massive impact.
I know.
Because Duffer Brothers. Yeah, they've already announced
Stranger Things.
They've already announced that Stranger Things production has been affected by it. And like Severance, a show that I was, you know, I talked it up on the show and I absolutely loved season one. I've been dying for season two, and that's been halted as well, and it's just, I think Rings of Power has not been affected by it, but like,
good, because that's already going to take like 7
years. And I don't know about The Last of Us, because that was tentatively scheduled to shoot late this year, but I don't know how that works, like, because it's so weird with the writer's strike. It all depends upon like what union you're involved in, and again, I'm no expert, hence why I didn't put it in the news, because I just don't know enough about it, nor do I care enough to research it. I just know that like it will obviously affect things, but yeah, because it's like, I don't know if it's like, well, if Neil and Craig don't care, they can just like write the scripts, right? Like, I did, but again, I'm just guessing. But yeah, I don't. Yeah. But yeah, it sucks. So like, we're gonna be like, say Stranger Things. Those guys are gonna be like bearded and balding by the time we next see them. Like, it's gonna be hilarious.
Yeah, that's the thing that you know, we're already gone off on a few tangents. But like, that's the thing that really sucks with that, is that I get like the writer's strike, and I get that like if they want to do it collectively, that then like we say, like Neil and. Like, yeah, if he then writes it, it's kind of difficult, like, to go against, like, you know, his group, if you know what I mean, and you kind of have to stand with them, really, in a lot of respects, and I get that. But with Stranger Things, we've got such a finite window until, like, those kids are 50-year-old men. Like, they're all just going to look like David Harbour. Yeah, I know. Like, we got Murray already. Yeah. Like, we don't, like, you know, Mike just looks like Murray. I'm like,
oh, that's going to be brilliant. I'm all for it.
Yeah, I mean, the more I've said it, the more I'm kind of for it. Like, they should just wait 20
years. Yeah.
And be like, screw it.
Yeah, and like, don't explain it either. Like, it's not set 20 years after. Like, it's set right after the last season.
No, they're still at school. Yeah. They're still at school. Like, Elle and Mike are still, like, awkwardly, like, together.
Yeah.
Like, Will hasn't come out. Like, it's all the same.
Yeah.
Like...
good times. But, yeah, that's it for another week. That was episode 347. Thanks for listening, as always, and we'll see you again very soon.
See you later, everyone. I never could, and how could I start that?